Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal for Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah.
No. Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your App Store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power.
Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good.
Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Now, you're very welcome back. So very happy to say Declan Lynch of the Sunday Independent joins us. He's also the author of, amongst other things, Days of Heaven, Italia 90 and the Charlton Years, Irish Soccer's Finest Hour. Declan, how you doing?
Oh, Joe.
So I would presume Days of Hell is somewhere in the works, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, it would take a while to get up for a retrospective on what's going on at the moment. One of the things that has occurred to me watching the Finding Jack Charlton documentary and also Ross Whittaker's one, the Italian 90 one, just the amount of talent that Ireland had on the pitch is kind of mind-boggling when you look back at it. The one thing that has changed for me looking at it is we should probably have done a lot better. We've underachieved. I think psychologically we've always felt, we'll take anything we get. Just as an Irish thing, we have lack of self-esteem. So we think, any crumb that drops from the table will be okay for us. But when you actually look at all these players, there's Liam Brady and Frank Stapleton, world-class players, and Ronnie Whelan. Will Ronnie even get his game today? It's kind of staggering when you think of it. Paul McGrath, Paul McGrath scoring a goal. All throughout those documentaries, the abundance of, compared to where we are now, just this abundance of just talented players, really good footballers that we had, is kind of striking, Did you feel that looking at it?
Yeah, it was incredible. When did you first start watching the Irish team, or when do you remember first starting to watch the Irish team?
As a child, my father would take me from Athlone up to Dalymount to see Ireland playing. I saw Eamon Dunphy playing for Ireland.
Yeah.
I always remember the image I have in my head is that I heard Ireland scoring a few goals, but I never saw them scoring a goal. Because I'd be in Dalymount, and everyone would start, if Don Givens usually would have a chance, and everyone would just stand up. And I had to judge by either the groan and everyone sitting down, or the jubilant kind of exultation whether we had scored or not. So I didn't mind not actually seeing Ireland ever scoring a goal, but that was the situation. So I was literally that young,
It's funny, you mentioned Eamon Dunphy. So, in his 23 caps, he only won two games. And I was just looking back to try and put this all into context in a way. So, look, I can do it in terms of facts and you can give me mood, which is maybe more the point, because the mood right now feels very low. So, to give the facts, 1968 to 1971, in those 4 years, Ireland failed to win a single match between 68 and 71, admittedly against often very good opposition. And then 72... at Dalymount, there was a 2-1 win against France. Ray Tracy scored the winner. Liam Toohey was in his manager. And then, followed the Giles era, which was 36 games, won 13, lost 14. But you have things happening there, like the Don Givens hat-trick game against Soviet Union. Liam Brady's making his debut at 18 in 1974. So that kind of period, did that feel hopeless? Or did you think, my God, we've got some really great, great players here? Or how do you compare it to what we're going through these last 3 years?
Of competence, if you like, I never thought we were Brazil, but I didn't think we were terrible either. It was kind of an unusual sort of thing, as a kid, I would bring home the program from the matches, right, and I would study them for months afterwards, and all the players were playing in the English First Division and stuff. You'd have someone like Jimmy Conway playing at fullback, who played for Fulham. So they were playing at quite a high level. In the context of the time, you had people like Charlie Hurley playing. Giles himself would, you know, play, and Dunphy was good. You know what I mean? Like, he was a skillful player, a very talented player. You know, so I think they were the whole setup for Ireland was hideous before Giles really reformed it. You know, it was the classic thing. They'd arrive on the boat practically, you know, on the day of the match. All these horror stories about bad organisation and everything, right? But the actual players, like Tony Dunn used to play at full-back, European Cup winner with Manchester United. So I think we've always had, I would say up until now, I think we're, our real crisis now is the talent has kind of run out to a large extent. And most poignantly, we had two examples of very talented. We had Declan Rice and Jack Grealish. And I find it impossible to address anything that's going on at the moment without, you know, going back all the time to the fact that we had these two guys and now they're playing for England. Mm. And we can't afford that. We just can't. I mean, they're, you know, international football now, if you have even one good player, one outstanding player, you can go a long way. I mean, that's almost the template now for countries who aren't, say, France, who don't have, like, lavish, you know, loads of really brilliant players. A lot of teams do pretty well with two good players, you know, and we had them, and it doesn't matter how it happened, but England have them now, and you can't do that. Like, I mean, we don't have the wriggle room there, I don't think.
Mm. Is your sense that we messed up on that front?
We clearly did. I mean, it isn't even an opinion, like, it's a catastrophe, you know. I mean, even if you just imagine even one of them in the current team.
I'm with you. Maybe I should have phrased it better. I almost mean, would there have been a degree of hoodwinking guys who, you know, we would have got them in before they'd matured and knew deep down, or had the confidence to admit deep down, look, I do feel more English. I'd prefer to play for England. Would we feel good about ourselves now if we had a couple of lads that we got in early?
Oh, I think we shouldn't care one way or the other. Just get them in, you know. I mean, any player, there's a very good precedent in all of these things. Like, any player who was kind of even almost like fooled into signing into playing for Ireland,
yeah,
never really regretted it. I mean, Mark Lawrence and Andy Townsend would be two outstanding examples of players who could easily have played for England and never, I think, had a moment's regret. They did really well with Ireland. They had a great time. And often with England, it's a nightmare playing for England, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, with Ireland, they'd be the big fish in the small pond and all this kind of stuff. There were great attractions to playing for Ireland, and there is very little history of someone being press-ganged into playing for Ireland and regretting it for the rest of their lives. In fact, the opposite is the case. So it was an error of historic proportions not to nail those guys down. Look, talent is everything. If you look at the way that people like Alex Ferguson, the lengths that they would go to nail down is a talented young player. Even like Peter Lorimer, there's a lot of stories about Peter Lorimer when he died last week about, you know, he was one of the best young players in Scotland. And, you know, there'd be rumours that, you know, Manchester United had given a bag full of like 5,000 quid to his house to try and lure the family into signing. Like, there's always been, like, young players, young talented players are so precious. And we seem to kind of have an attitude of, like, oh, whatever is best for the lads, you know. That level of almost desperation that you would see in great managers like Ferguson, we seem to have a much more kind of holistic approach to the whole thing. And look where we are now.
Clearly, watching Ireland play football meant a lot to you. I mean, you literally wrote the book on the Charlton years. What does it evoke for you now when you watch us play over the last couple of years?
Very little, Joe, I'm sorry to say. You know, I just lament the fact that Duffer is almost the last really good player that we had, you know. Something has happened there. It's a far too big a subject to try and explain it now. I just look at what we have on the pitch, and all I can think of is, you know, the amount of talent that we used to have, even among our bit players. You know what I mean? Like, when you look back at that, players like Tony Galvin, you know, even our sort of, inverted commas, our average players were good, you know, Chris Hughton, players like that. Mm. Where are players like that now? I mean, we you know, this whole thing of a guy is brought on and you've never heard of him before. You know, I think that's quite a common. I don't think it's just me. I think it's quite a common response, even among people who are very into football. They're saying, who is that guy? You know, where does he come from? I think it's very difficult to be blaming Stephen Kenny at this stage because, you know, the damage was done, I think, with the loss of those. I think it's almost as simple as that, that with one or two players like Rice and Grealish, I think we had a chance. We'd always have a chance because they tend to bring up the players around them or raise the performances of others around them. And I just have this sense of just emptiness at the moment and not great sort of, not a lot of hope, Joey, you know. I'd be delighted if they kind of improved, and I'd be delighted if other players came along, of course. We looked like we were some great goalkeepers.
Yeah.
And my God, I think they're going to be needed, you know.
Yeah. Okay. So, that does sound a lot grimmer than even late 60s, early 70s, despite the four-year run of no wins, given the quality of player that was there now. And now you're turning on the TV when you would think with the internet, you wouldn't have to be asking who's your man. But
yeah.
that's where we were. It is quite, it was a real perfect storm when you think about it, that at the time that John Delaney's grip on the FAI was at its strongest, the English academies, who had, you know, allowed us not to be self-sufficient for so many decades, the English academies were becoming global meritocracies. And now, a decade on, even from the 2012 squad with Duffer and Keane and Richard Dunn and, you know, any number of really, really good players, a decade on, this decade, I think, has been the decade where it's come home to roost, hasn't it?
Yeah, and I always think back at Trapattoni, you know, the according to the legend or rumour, Trapp really deep down felt that we had two players, Shea Given and Robbie Keane. I think it was as if he felt all the rest of them were completely interchangeable. You know, he could have nine other human beings there, you know, but he rated those two as, like, very serious footballers. I think it's gone into decline since then, you know. I'd be delighted if it were different. I mean, can you offer me anything there, Joe? I mean, where are you coming from here?
Not far behind you. I'm hoping that the blooding of all these young players that we haven't quite heard of yet, but the likes of Jason Knight, who apparently really will be the real deal in 2, 3, 4 years' time, that decision will have aged very well.
Troy Parrott
is there.
Does it? The one. I mean, clearly, Jose has done everything in his power to break his spirit for reasons better known to himself.
Well, this is what Jose likes to do. I should tell you, by the way, sorry, I've robbed you, because I'm about to let you go now, because we're 3 minutes into the game. I've robbed you of the three best minutes of the Stephen Kenny regime, because I'm watching it here, and honestly, they have been like Brazil, and they've just scored. It's been incredible. Like, you can't imagine what you've just missed. I'm not even exaggerating here. They've been unbelievable for the last 3 minutes, and they've scored. James McLean has scored with a set-piece, brilliant corner move straight from the training ground.
Oh, wow.
Now, why they didn't use that set-piece training ground move on Saturday, that's up for debate, but we'll...
they're like men possessed. Joe, I take it all back.
A last point. Given you spent a lot of your time thinking about Jack Charlton and living through it, I take it you enjoyed that documentary which went out in Virgin the other week, or the other night.
Yeah, I thought it was wonderful. I mean, I made a brief contribution to it myself, but the whole thing was wonderful. I was talking to the guys obviously when they were making it on the day that they just did a little interview with me, and I could tell that they were really good. You know, that they had a kind of a sense of what they wanted to do, and they were often with these things. You just sit down, you talk for 2 hours. And they chop it all up at the end, and it's a bit of a mess. But they seem to have a real kind of line as they wanted to go on, and they were very well organized. And I was really impressed by them.
That's interesting.
It, sure enough, actually worked out. It worked out really well.
Oh,
it just was a higher class of football program. You know, like it really gave you a sense of a whole life and a fascinating career. Like an amazing man, Jack Shark. Just such a talented individual in so many ways, and a great character. And they really, you know, did him justice, I think, in a way that so many football documentaries so often don't. They just stay away from the more, the deeper aspects of a person's mind or a person's personality, you know. So I thought it was great.
Yeah, so many moments in it, like when he turned to his granddaughter, when he clocked it was him being the television presenter, or there was a day out and he was conversing with a young man with learning disabilities, and it was you know, very poignant. Or obviously, I think a lot of people were struck by that moment in the midst of all the, you know, terrible confusion he was suffering from, where he spots Paul McGrath and just says Paul McGrath and turns to the camera and smiles. I mean, for those moments to be caught on camera, just extraordinary.
It's a great moment. And even then, the sort of the subplots, with, like, his relationship with Bobby is really interesting.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. And he's such a huge figure, Charlton, such a huge personality. And it really comes across. So that's about as good as you can get, I think.
Listen, I'll let you go. Like I said, they're on fire right now.
Yeah,
so.
Like I said, everything I've said for the last 15, 17 minutes, think nothing of it.
Yeah, standard, as usual.
Okay.
Right, thanks a million, Declan Lynch. Cheers. Declan Lynch there of the Sunday Independent. And the book, by the way, I remember reading it years ago, and it's still well worth digging out. Days of Heaven, Italia 90, and the Charlton Years, Irish Soccer's Finest Hour. I'm not kidding you, by the way. I wasn't exaggerating. Honestly, for the first 3-4 minutes here, Ireland were just brilliant. Like, all these flowing one-touch moves, cutting Qatar apart. McLean has scored the opener, so they're 1-0 up after 7 minutes.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
You're welcome along to the football show. An hour gone. It's Qatar 1, Ireland 1. Ireland, if you're just tuning in, took the lead courtesy of James McLean. It was a training ground move from a corner, worked to perfection, and that was that. And then on the stroke of the second half whistle, Qatar equalised. Ball kind of fell to a striker edge of the area who turned on it, hit it pretty well into the side netting. Bazuno dived. Wasn't a whole lot he could do about it. It was a good strike. And so that is where we are. An hour gone. Qatar 1, Ireland 1. A couple of substitutions just made. Daryl Horgan off, Jason Knight on, and Colm Robinson has come off the bench for Shane Long as well. Obviously, our Group A friends are playing without us this evening. Serbia beat Azerbaijan by 2-1. It was far from comfortable. Our friend Mitrovic scored both goals. They took the lead and then Azerbaijan equalised. And then it was the 81st minute when Mitrovic scored the winner. So that was a 2-1 win in the end for Serbia. And then Luxembourg took the lead against Portugal. Gerson Rodriguez, who scored against us, obviously, scored on 30 minutes. Diogo Jota equalised on 45 minutes. And now in the 51st minute, Ronaldo has put Portugal 2-1 up. So maybe that makes us feel a touch better about Saturday. It's certainly not a 5-6-0 mauling by Portugal or anything close to it. Very happy to say Miguel Delaney of the London Independent is with us. Evening.
Evening. How are you doing?
Very well. So Qatar, Ireland in an empty stadium in Hungary. If there's a better way to capture this nightmarish dystopia we're living in, this could, you know, I wouldn't like to see it, Miguel.
That we mightn't win.
Well,
just to add to it.
Yeah. wasn't it interesting? We chose this evening to unleash our brilliant training ground routine from a corner.
I know. But I mean, the one thing I was thinking from that first half, actually, now it's changed a bit because now Qatar are beginning to get the upper hand. But maybe it would have been better to play this game before the Luxembourg game, and it might have had some actual use, because it does feel like just throughout this match, and I actually felt this during the Serbia game as well, the team look a bit more relaxed and more confident. And I wonder, given they haven't had that win yet, and obviously goals have been a struggle, is there an issue? Is there going to be kind of almost a psychological block when it comes to games where they're expected to win, like that Luxembourg one, where like there was a bit of a return to the first few games under Kenny, when, you know, the team just seemed almost asphyxiated by the approach they were trying to play. They weren't completely comfortable, they weren't relaxed. But now in situations where they're not expected to win, or there's not pressure to win, They have looked a little bit better. And I do wonder whether that will be an issue going forward until we finally get that victory.
I mean, it's one of the interesting questions. A whole host of unknowables about this whole situation, aren't there? I mean, is this generation that Kenny has pinned his hopes on well worth pinning his hopes on? And will they come through and develop? And will we benefit from this early blooding of the likes of Knight and Troy Parrott's playing this evening, which is kind of interesting, or will in a couple of years, you know, will it fail to materialise? Who knows where they'll all end up? That's one of the great unknowables amongst many other.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I know there's been a lot of parallels drawn in the last few days between this period and Michael O'Neill's early period in Northern Ireland and some of the results he had, and whether it can be a similar hope there once Kenny develops some sort of kind of a cohesion or coherence in the team. And you can almost say the same of Luxembourg, and it's amazing. I mean, tonight actually could end up, in fact, what's happened so far probably already has changed a few perceptions of what happened on Saturday and what Luxembourg represent, because they really aren't the kind of minnow I think we probably would have associated with them for most of football history, and certainly from the 80s and 90s. I mean, I remember growing up, or when, like, during Jack's time, Luxembourg would have always been seen as basically, oh, that's the standard whipping boys of any group. But that really isn't the case anymore. And some of that has come from, they've improved their structures, but also they've got a group of a team there that's played together an awful lot, right through a Nations League campaign. And for small to medium-sized countries, which is what we are, that is a potential solution going forward. The same happened with Northern Ireland. But I suppose the bigger issue is, this is what we have to look to, because we're in something of a fallow period as regards the quality of players available, which, you know, it has been a bigger debate over these last few days as well.
Yeah, it sure has. Not least because your piece from 6 years ago really felt all the more painful, I think. It's really come home to roost.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people would have seen it, but then again, not everyone is on Twitter and we can overestimate these things. So, in effect, I mean, some of the lines which stayed with me, a European official at the time, and so we're talking, you know, 6-7 years ago, described.
Yeah, so this was actually December. I finished the, all those interviews for it were done basically September to December 2013.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, a European official in 2011 described the Irish football structure as crazy as anything he had seen. And I think as well, Wim Hoevermans, who came in 2009, the most important appointment in Irish football history, the high performance director at the time, since replaced obviously by Ruud Doctor. I think you cite a meeting he was having in 2010 with Schoolboy Football Association of Ireland. There'd been a review and there were 51 recommendations the previous year, and these recommendations were things like, you know, small-sided, non-competitive under 11 games, standard stuff. I think the point was made in the meeting that Spanish and the Germans had been doing it for a long, long time. And one of the administrators' response was, what the F would they know about Irish football? Which for me was a real head in the hands moment, I have to say.
Oh, yeah. But I think as anyone that's worked anywhere close to kind of schoolboy football, that sort of attitude just wouldn't be a surprise to anyone. And this has been half the problem. And I think it's something that strikes all the more given the events at the very top of Irish football in the last few years, where so much of the structure, I mean, just one source who used to work at the FAI, the example they kept citing to me was the Limerick Desmond League. And with no disrespect to anyone that's worked at it, but it was cited like, if you have a proper pyramid structure in the way you would idealise, and the way most countries have now, that basically is a competition that shouldn't really exist. It shouldn't have a place. It should all be much more streamlined and regionalised. But I suppose one of the problems was that John Delaney, for all the no relation, for all the authority he had, and you know, and how secure his position was in Irish football. Part of that was because his power base was so strong, and one of the reasons his power base was strong was because in things like this. And I remember talking to John Delaney about this back when he was on friendlier terms with media. And he was talking about these issues. And I remember when I did an interview with him for the Sunday Tribune, he was talking about how it was one of his big goals to get youth football fixed. But he wouldn't make these, or the regime at the time wouldn't make these unpopular decisions, because to make these unpopular decisions basically created potential, I don't want to say enemies, but people who wouldn't necessarily be happy with the direction of the FAI in that sense. And that's been a constant issue. And it meant that rather than the kind of the year zero that has happened with every single successful federation or overhaul in modern football history. So I suppose what we're talking about since the examples of the French in the mid-90s, Spain and Germany in the early 2000s, that they've all had that. They've all had that reckoning moment. And it feels like even though there's been a few wake-up calls for us over the years, we still haven't. And I think, well, I mean, I suppose I've been working in the UK media now exclusively for the past 4 years, so I haven't been covering Irish issues. So, I mean, that piece, so from what I hear, some changes have been made, but some issues still persist. So a lot still exists. And it feels like it's all been done in a piecemeal way, and it's a challenge still to sort. Even though people talk of how coaching at base level is very good and individual coaches are excellent, there are still structural issues that have to be sorted. But of course, that comes at a time now where the FAI are more financially stretched than ever before. And to be fair, that was an issue in the past. Well, even beyond the kind of the wider discussions around that.
Mm. I just want to play people a clip if they didn't catch it. Vinnie Perth of Dundalk obviously was on OTB AM this morning, and they were having a wide-ranging chat and focused on the game for a lot of it. But towards the end, they got into a really interesting chat about this very issue. And it's really about, where are we now? Have we had our year zero? And I mean, I'm sure you're hearing the broad situation. National leagues are starting, and we're handing over the development of our youth players to the League of Ireland clubs. And like Brian Kerr was on Virgin Media, TV3 in your day, Miguel, before you took off. And he was saying, you know, he's not so sure about that. He said, you know, to use his exact wording, League of Ireland clubs, a lot of them don't have a pot to pee in. So frankly, you know, and they've no culture of bringing through players. There's no intellectual property there going back generations, or, you know, and there's just no tradition of it. So we're handing them over, and League of Ireland clubs can be a volatile bunch at the best of times. And so he's not even sure what's happening now is the right thing. So Vinnie Perth was talking about this this morning. And to be fair, he wasn't as you know, sure that we were going down the wrong route. But he was talking about the fact, as you'll hear, the likes of a Cherry Orchard or a Home Farm or these great clubs, St. Kevin's, who brought through lots of players, now feel incredibly marginalised. And aside from Shamrock Rovers, who are doing things properly, we're not so sure what the standard is across the rest of the League of Ireland clubs. Now, it could be very good. We don't know. That's almost where we are at the moment. Have a listen to Vinnie Perth. It's just a clip on OTBAM this morning.
We're doing better now. They are. They're genuinely doing better. But they aren't good enough yet, all of them, to run the whole academy all the way through. We see the money it costs at Shamrock Rovers to do it. And they should have been forced to link up with them. Home Farm has just been, Belvedere, they've just been left behind. Yeah, Shelbourne then, over that part of the city in Dublin, go on and create a whole schoolboy setup from under nines all the way up, which takes years and years to develop. And you've got Home Farm and Belvedere within the door, and they weren't forced to marry up together. That makes no sense to me. I'm not being critical of anyone in Shelbourne or Home Farm, but the FAI should have had a long-term view of this and kept these clubs on board and the expertise that they have. Like Richard Dunn was developed at Home Farm. Troy Pard was developed at Belvedere. And we've just thrown them aside. So, I, and by the way, Rude Doctor has to create elitism. We have to have these national leagues, the under 15s, 17s, 19s. They're the way forward. But we've just taken out people who have been doing the job for 40, 50 years and just got rid of them and made clubs restart again. And to be fair, to Bowles and Rovers, they're the only two clubs, I would say, doing it right. And not to say the likes of Sligo are bringing through John Kenny, through their underage setup. There is things happening in pockets around the country, but there's no joint up thinking. And I think the engagement that Rude schoolboy clubs football would say is non-existent. That's what they tell me. I wasn't at that cold face long enough to know what's the truth, but the likes of Cherry Arch would tell you they've just been dismissed. They even tried recently, this whole Dublin County tried to get into the League of Ireland First Division. Cherry Orchard were willing to provide them with the schoolboy setup for their club, which meant under 13, 15, 17 National League, we had another 20 to 25 players playing at that elite level. And we made the decision that Dublin County, for whatever reason, rightly or wrongly, weren't going to do it. So we have a real problem, and there's so much infighting. I don't see it being fixed anytime soon, and that's the concern. And we're being left behind by Luxembourg and Iceland and all of these nations that are way ahead of us.
Vinnie Perth, that was him on OTBAM this morning. As you can hear there, the full chat is worth a download. We're here with Miguel Delaney of the London Independent, still 1-1 between Qatar and Ireland. So short version there, Miguel, stuff like they're trying stuff and we're, you know, getting bits off the ground that feel like best practice, and then you dig into the realities and there's still a lot of infighting and there's a lot of question marks over just how right what we're doing is. So I don't know. I mean, you might be able to write another piece in about 5, 6, 7 years by the sounds of things. And that's the tricky thing, isn't it? We're now, it's yet another generation, in this new experiment.
I mean, the key word that Vinny used there is infighting. It's something you hear all the time about this, especially given like the different power blocks in Irish football and how it's been constructed for so long. Interesting, but like for that piece, it was suggested to me at the time as well that perhaps one of the potential pathways could be more League of Ireland clubs kind of, you know, bringing the successful schoolboy clubs, the ones that have produced a lot of our players, into their umbrella. Although it's interesting, I mean, Neil O'Riordan did a good piece in the Irish Sun today, so where he pointed out there's actually been a bit of a historical break in the last few years where, oddly, we've only had two players from Dublin to come through in, I can't remember the exact period you said.
93 to 98.
Yeah, which was really striking.
Yeah.
Given, and I did wonder how much of that is also connected to the fact that the GAA almost run an evangelical program as regards kind of youth in Dublin. I mean, where they've, you know, they...
Listen, Miguel, if you want to kick Dublin GAA, there's a long queue on this show. Don't worry about that.
but it is striking. That's not to criticise Dublin GAA, but they've been so successful at that in a way that's kind of almost totally, from what you hear, totally overridden soccer, which I suppose, given that would have been my sport and I would have played, you know, in South Dublin and all that. It is something that that stands out.
It's probably so many things. And I guess the last point in this, because I do want to talk to you about the Qatar protests. I mean, the other point, which people obviously know as well, is that our timing has been rotten in that, you know, the peak of the Delaney era has coincided with Premier League academies becoming these global meritocracies. You're not just going up against the best of, you know, the Scots, the Welsh and the English, and Irish players get their chances. That's obviously, that ship has sailed. So now we have to be self-sufficient and we're just nowhere near ready.
And actually, to be fair, this is a little bit of a tangent, but I do wonder, say, in football of 1986, it was a much more regionalised world where you had kind of quotas and foreign player limits and all the rest of it. And I wonder if football was more globalised in that world, how high some of our players, who were obviously exceptional players, but I wonder would that change perceptions or what level they would have reached? Because, you know, essentially, if you were a good Irish player in those days, you almost got to one of the better English clubs by default. Now, but still, obviously, I mean, this isn't to diminish the talent of what was undoubtedly our greatest ever squad. But that has been an issue. And you'd wonder as well, maybe would some of our current players be that bit higher if it was less globalised? But this is the current reality, and it's something else we have to work on. But then again, I mean, I think it's always been a point worth stressing, given we get into kind of wider eternal debates about Irish football here. But ideally, the League of Ireland should be really something akin to the Belgian or Dutch league, where it's a brilliant finishing school for our best young players. I mean, if we're living in, you know, the best possible world for Irish football, that would be it.
It sure would. Look, we'll have this conversation again in a few months, whenever the next disaster happens, and we'll rinse, wash and repeat. The Qatar situation, quite interesting, of late players from Germany, from Norway, from Netherlands staging very high profile protests. Stephen Kenny yesterday in his press conference, and I suspect, and Dan McDonald was on and he felt the same thing, if Kenny hadn't been off the back of such a terrible loss, he might have been even, you know, more willing to engage with this. But it's obviously hard to take too much of your eyes off the road ahead when things aren't going well. But Kenny said there's a clear issue with human rights in the building of stadiums in Qatar, the number of people who've died. You can't sweep that under the carpet. It can't be ignored. Initially, the Norwegian team and various other teams have backed that. They're entitled to do it with good reason. It's not acceptable for people to lose their lives. The disparity of wealth between rich and poor, to have people live in conditions of squalor and people dying in those conditions, is not acceptable. So the protests of Germany and Norway and the Netherlands, there's no sign of FIFA cracking down on this political protest as such.
No, I mean, they've let it go, I suppose, because were they to crack down on it, it would lead to a lot more criticism about FIFA. But I have to say, especially given those words you read out from Stephen Kenny, I think this is going to be maybe, you know, this game will prompt a lot of discussion about the direction of the team and all that. But from a wider perspective, I think the most significant thing about this game is the fact that, and I have to say I was a little bit disappointed to see it, that we didn't even wear one of those T-shirts. It doesn't necessarily even mention Qatar, but something that the Norwegian players wear, just some little gesture towards the situation, even if something that says human rights, as the Norwegians did. And, you know, it is unfair to put pressure on players to expect things and all that. But also, you know, we can't really plead ignorance in all this anymore, especially when Norway and Germany have now made what is an increasingly big issue about it. And, this debate is probably going to grow over the next 2 years, but there's always, you know, the counter argument, well, how much can players actually do, how much can federations actually do? But in this case, actually, they do have some power. And like to even the mildest statement, especially when you're playing the host nation, when that game is going to be beamed through Qatar, it would have had a bit of effect. And I have to say, I mean, again, you don't want to actually blame the players or criticize them that way, but I have to say I was a little bit disappointed not to see something given the opportunity there and given the discussion over the last few days. But personally speaking, how I'd see it.
Mm. Well, I suppose they've huge power when this is a football-related issue. This isn't sports people going way outside their lane.
Well, exactly. And also, this is... And we can't escape this either. And I should stress that this isn't to criticise taking the knee in any way. Because I think there's been a bit of a kind of a dynamic where the lack of protest about Qatar has been used to undermine the taking the knee. I don't think that should be the case. But rather, it is still fair to point out that by taking the knee, players have created a newly politicised football world where suddenly all this comes into the arena. Because, you know, especially when you're talking about something like racial inequality, well, you couldn't have a clearer example going by the UN report last year of racial inequality than the situation in Qatar for migrant workers right now. And this is the sphere of discussion now. And, you know, when we have a world where we are taking the, I think the natural follow-on questions, well, what about this when you're literally playing games to qualify for a competition where this is one of the dominant issues? I think the amount of quiet around football in this has been disappointing. Yeah. I think it still shows how closed off the game is, and even the fact that such limited countries doing it, or sorry, limited in terms of numbers, makes such a ripple in that sense, you know, shows the power there and shows how much more could be done. And this is where players do have genuine power.
No, they do for sure. And it's on FIFA's watch, and it's very embarrassing for FIFA and all concerned. And like, as you said, ignorance probably isn't really an excuse when one Guardian article last week laid out the whole thing, even if you'd come blind to it. And I don't think many people have. So the latest dispatch last month, 6,500 workers dead since 2010. They're low paid migrants. They're coming from the likes of India and Pakistan and Nepal and Bangladesh and Sri Lanka. So we're averaging about 12 per week, which is shocking. And this is part of the overall infrastructure overhaul. It's not just stadia, but it's all World Cup connected. There's a 2 million strong migrant workforce in Qatar. And what was interesting in the most recent Guardian piece is that they were pointing out that a huge number of the deaths are deemed natural causes. So up to 69% of these deaths, natural causes. So what happens is, you know, family get a phone call and say your beloved son, brother, father was found dead in his room in our accommodation that we provide this morning. Death, natural cause. Here's his unpaid €700 in wages, no compensation needed, no autopsy, thanks, effectively. You know, that's kind of how it goes. And, you know, that's just unsatisfactory for obvious reasons. Can you imagine if we were on the end of that phone call? In 2019, in that same piece in The Guardian, the UN research established heat as a potential factor here. So we could be talking, you know, heart failure or respiratory issues. A lot of the work is done at nighttime because it is so incredibly hot there. 2014, some Qatari officials recommended that autopsies be carried out. And here we are 7 years later, the autopsies still don't happen. Now, Qatar have come out and said, look, these deaths are exaggerated. They include white collar workers. It's not as, you know, flagrant as the stark figure of 6,500 sounds. However, The Guardian in that same piece pointed to inconsistencies and a lack of data in their explanation. So I guess you take it with a pinch of salt, however much salt you want. 6,500 workers dead since 2010 is absolutely horrendous. And that is before we mention the conditions those who have survived are living and working in and the abuses which have happened there. I mean, where does this World Cup rank, do you think, in horrific World Cups?
I mean, obviously it was like 1934, you know, Mussolini in Italy, 1978, the junta in Argentina.
Yeah.
And even the last World Cup with 2018 with Russia. But
yeah,
what feels so different with this World Cup, or maybe comparable to 34 in that way, is the sense of how much the tournament is being used as a state vehicle. It's so central. In a way, it wasn't Russia. So Russia, say, I mean, especially by the time it was actually being staged, I mean, Putin probably didn't, there was all that talk about whether he actually even wanted it. But with this, it's, and this is why it's not just that it's a politicized World Cup. It's that literally every single element of it is so politicized. So you've got the reason for it. I mean, obviously with the ownership of Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain, who are also Qatar, over the past few years, sports washing has been a big phrase. This is a clear an example of sports washing as you could have. It's basically, you know, a country using sport or football or an event to try and soften their image and kind of shift the discussion around them on the international stage and also make them more acceptable when there are questions about the human rights record. Then, of course, you have the winning of it, given there are still questions about how exactly the it came about that Qatar and Russia won the vote in 2010. For 2018-22, for the first time in April 2020, the U.S. Department of Justice actually wrote the accusations, or you know, put it clear, accusations of bribery. Now Qatar, of course, you know, had a strident statement against that. But then, of course, there's every nature, and this is why the power of the players and FIFA is so relevant. Because I mean, you mentioned there about kind of Qatar responses to the situation. But one of the things Amnesty has criticised Qatar for, they said, yes, there's been changes, but those changes haven't yet been implemented. And this is where football has a serious lever to pull. Like, if you talk to people in human rights, which I've done a lot for these pieces, you know, it's a theory of leverage in human rights activism, where you can use whatever influence you have to try and get a state responsible for human rights abuses or issues to change or to have some effect. And that's exactly the opportunity FIFA and football. You don't even have to go to an outright boycott. It's that by applying pressure, or by FIFA using the significant power of a World Cup, they can get Qatar to do more. But that hasn't happened. They basically, bar a bit of minor criticism, which doesn't really go that far, as you can see, it feels like Qatar has got all the reward from this World Cup without any of the required change. And it's why the players do have power. And it's also why, you know, people in these situations talk, well, why don't we criticise America in 2026? Well, we can get to that. But for the moment, even still, the American situation doesn't really compare to the nature of what this Qatar World Cup is. And like, I have to say, I've been thinking about it myself. When you mention all those, you know, all the worker deaths and situations, because it's not just about the stadium. When we go to this World Cup in 2022, we'll be basically, we'll be staying in hotels or using metros or using roads or whatever part of the infrastructure that's there because of this World Cup that comes from a situation where a UN special reporter said there are conditions where there's been coercive work. And like, it doesn't really sit easily, I have to say. But again, and like, even when I was doing that piece last week, I was talking to people at human rights groups about this very issue. And the response was, I mean, they'd love it if the media didn't go, because if the media doesn't go, then it means a more sanitized image of that World Cup is put out. But it also means, I think, that I don't think you can go to this World Cup and treat it as a normal World Cup in that sense. And it's also, again, why we keep coming back to the players and this and their status, because basically it's unfair on them. But essentially, the players are being used in the situation. They're being used for sports washing, because by the very staging of the games, which naturally involves the players, it just helps soften that image and creates the spectacle. It's almost a distraction, or if you like, a classic example of sports washing.
Yeah. I mean, look, I guess you drill down into any hosting of an event like this, and ethically, you start to hit roadblocks pretty quickly. I felt in Brazil walking around at times that the amount of money that had been spent, given the poverty on view, was unethical. You know, you start to have those conversations. But when the migrant workers are literally dying and the explanations for their death are so vague deliberately, and we've seen the videos of the accommodation, I mean, something has to be done there. And then there's the other interesting thing, like the world view. Tony Burnett here, the chief executive of Kick It Out, was saying recently that he said 10 years ago we awarded the World Cup to a country where it's illegal to be gay. Forget the human rights abuses. That was a strange thing for him to say, I thought. But anyway, forget the human rights abuses. We awarded the World Cup to a country where it's still illegal to be gay. What message does that send? To me, it's exactly the same as awarding a World Cup to apartheid South Africa, telling black players it's fine. We're just trying to build their knowledge and build their educational awareness. He said, it's not appropriate. What does it say to the lesbian and gay community, and how seriously we take these issues when we're prepared?
Just dropped off.
Sorry, did you lose me there?
Yeah, I just lost you there a second ago, yeah.
Oh, yeah, sorry. You're back now, I think. Finally, he just said, look, it's not appropriate. What does it say to the lesbian and gay community about how seriously we take these issues when we're prepared to support a country that thinks it's okay, that it's not okay, rather, to be gay in hosting the biggest football event on the planet, end quote. So there's that other element, too, where, you know, huge swathes of the world won't agree with the worldview in Qatar when it comes to these issues as well. And you know, that's very, like, where do you stand on that? I mean, like, God, it's no picnic being gay in Russia either. So, you know, are you disappointed we're not seeing protests on issues like that as well?
I mean, yeah, again, it's all part of the many, many questions on this. And it is part of almost this kind of bizarre double-think world that football lives in, where on one side it tries to portray itself as a force for good and we have so many initiatives. Then when it actually comes to the reality of the sport, there's a bit more, too much quiet than we'd like. And I mean, you mentioned the kind of situation in Brazil, and I have been thinking about that a lot. But, and people talk about where you draw the line with these things.
Yeah.
But the reality actually is there is genuinely a sliding scale with these things. And, you know, very few countries are going to be, that could potentially stage a tournament, are going to completely, all will have issues.
Yeah.
But when the issues start to mount up, that's also when criticism needs to mount up as well. And Qatar, whatever you say about USA 2026 or even Brazil 2014, Qatar has as many issues as any modern tournament could have. And that's why yeah. I think the discussion needs to be much louder.
No, agreed. Final point, do you think it'll ramp up? Like it is, I mean, it's striking. We're not talking minnows here. Germany, the Netherlands, Norway as well. These are very strong protests, very high profile players. You know, it puts a spotlight on Ireland not having a protest this evening, for instance, you know, because it's now been done and it's now an accepted form of highlighting what these poor migrant workers are enduring. Do you think we're going to see, you know, the summer internationals and into November internationals, or hell, even club football, you know, when you think about it? Do you think we're going to see more of this now? Is this going to ramp up or drift away?
So that's an interesting one, because last week England put up John Stones. And I asked him about the Norwegian protests and whether the England players would do something similar. And he said they would discuss it in the squad. But that's remarkable given that the owner of John Stones' club is Sheikh Mansour, who is, you know, part of the Abu Dhabi royal family, who have been in a cold war with Qatar for so many years, and are an emirate who have been criticised for many of the same issues and for human rights abuses of their own, not least the participation in the war. And this is, you know, I mean, we're getting into much bigger topics here, but this is due to football's size and popularity and its political capital in that way. This is the world it's entered now, where it's become an extension of geopolitics and has a lot of uncomfortable questions when you start to get down into it. It'll probably go quiet now after this week finishes, especially because it's the Euros in the summer. But once the qualifiers come back round, and I suppose there's been that time to digest what's happened this week, it'll be very interesting to see whether it ramps up at all the next time. Mm. And even whether countries like Norway, especially given they're going to come closer to their extraordinary general meeting where they actually vote on a potential boycott, whether their protest goes beyond what is still quite an open-ended line on kind of, you know, human rights, and they actually directly name Qatar. So, at the very least, Norway have started the debate.
Yeah. There's a degree of the Barbra Streisand effect about their sports washing here. Like, I didn't know they treated their migrant workers so badly. I didn't know a lot of the human rights issues until they got the World Cup.
Yeah, but I mean, that's actually something that's come up a lot when you talk about, say, what it does for Manchester City or what it does for Paris Saint-Germain. But ultimately, the benefits far outweigh the kind of minimal criticism. Just because, I suppose, I mean, as someone put it to me, say with the Manchester City case, by Abu Dhabi owning the club and being involved in the kind of, you know, they've got a construction empire in Manchester, basically, it basically sends the message these guys are okay to do business with. So even if there are human rights issues there, that's a key to it. Despite the consciousness, the new consciousness about migrant worker situations in Qatar, it effectively means that relations with Qatar are normalized, or with these states are normalized, despite these issues ongoing. And that is the true benefit of sports washing and why it works.
Okay. Miguel Delaney, London Independent, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Cheers, Joe.
Cheers. Miguel Delaney there. Always great having him on. Latest from, where is this match on again? Hungary. 1-1 is where we are. Qatar and Ireland into the 93rd minute. Back in a sec.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Okay, you're welcome back. So a few things to discuss with Kathleen McNamee, whose work you can see on ESPN. Hi, Kathleen. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I saw you took to alcohol to watch the Luxembourg game on Twitter the other evening. Did you sit through Qatar, Ireland sober for us?
Yes, I did. I managed to. It's still ongoing in the background behind me, but I don't think I'm missing too much at the moment.
No, it's just gone full time on my screen, so you won't be far behind me here. So, well, it's another game for Stephen Kenny, another draw. I guess better than a loss.
Yeah.
They started well. We can say that much.
Yeah, it was a good 4 minutes. And after that, we didn't really get much. But yeah, it's just another really disappointing result and to add to all his misery.
Yeah. So I'm sure he's glad of the break now until summer. So a few things I wanted to talk to you about. Obviously, there was much hype and much build-up to Manchester United women's team playing at Old Trafford for the first time. They did it. They won 2-0. On they go. I was kind of surprised that this wasn't on TV. That was the kind of big surprise to me. I guess, look, no, it's nobody's fault. There's no crowd there. And I think it's better to play the game rather than waiting for the pandemic to be over. But it seems maybe it wasn't coordinated brilliantly with BT. They had their games already picked. I just would have thought, if we're doing this, let's make, you know, any opportunity to kind of make a big deal, you should take it.
Yeah, it was an interesting one. It actually was picked up kind of late by one of BT's subsidiary channels, but like, I have nearly every sports package there is known to man, and I couldn't find it anywhere, so it still was really difficult to watch. I watched it on the FA player, but I think Casey Stoney was really right when she was talking about it, and she said sometimes we're quite short-sighted and we get overexcited about making these big gestures and having these big moments and don't actually think through the consequences of it. Like, for me, if you were able to have that game in a couple of months, of like, England are looking at getting crowds back a lot sooner than we are, you could have had loads of kids there, loads of young boys and girls, would have been really exciting. Players could have had their families. Like you said, it could have been on TV. It just seemed like a really weird decision from all involved, and a bit kind of like they wanted to shove it in rather than doing it as something that was really important. And that said, it wasn't the most blistering game in the world either, so maybe it is would be better to leave it for another point and have it as a bit more of an exciting matchup. But it was strange, and it was strange the way it only came out a couple of days before the game, with things like the North London Derby. Like, we knew a couple of weeks in advance that Arsenal and Spurs were going to be playing at the Tottenham Stadium, so I don't really know where the lack of communication was there, but I think it was a real missed opportunity. I know I watched on the FA player, and the game ended and that was it. Like, yeah. There's no analysis, there's no commentary, there's no kind of excitement. It just felt really flash, yes. Which for me was a massive disappointment.
Yeah, get your pundits on the pitch, go and talk to a player too. What was the experience like? You know, sell it. God.
Yeah, exactly. Someone like Lauren James as well, scoring their first goal ever at Old Trafford. You know, I think she has some ridiculous stat. Like, she scored their first Championship goal, WSL and FA Cup goal. You know, Reece James's sister. There's so many great lines that you could have got out of her there. And I mean, they went on social media afterwards, but definitely missed.
Chelsea are top of the table, Man City are second, Man United are third. United were slow coming to the party, really, when it came to women's football. But I know, talking to a few players, even Louise Quinn recently enough was saying, in fairness, they have been slow, but they're doing things properly now that they are up and running. So third in the table, that suggests, I mean, suddenly we have Chelsea, Man City, Man United, Arsenal as the top four in the table. That suggests that money's talking there.
Yeah, definitely. I think Manchester United in particular really benefited this year from having Tobin Heath and Kristen Press come. And since Heath has been injured, you've really seen a drop off in their form. Like you said, they've been building very slowly and making sure they get it right at the youth levels and that they're bringing players through rather than spending that big money. But this year, getting those two players coming over, getting that World Cup experience, that US women's national team experience, just like shot them right up the table and really, really helps them. It's interesting now as well, because you have United and Arsenal both vying for that last Champions League place. And it looks like Arsenal might do it after a whole season of being kind of second to United. So it's really interesting. And it's been interesting to see how they have taken their younger players, nurtured them. Casey Stoney is very strong in the fact that she doesn't want this to be a team that just comes in and maybe does what Chelsea or City have done in the past and just buy all around them. She wants to work with her squad. And they've also been quite unfortunate with injuries. And she said that was mainly down to a lot of players who have been injured, didn't get much of a preseason, and now have struggled because of that. But I think they're a really interesting model for teams that are looking to create new, like, women's divisions, because they've grown quite quickly, but they've shown you can do it with not having to throw absolutely everything at it. You know, you can just bring in a good manager, have good starting players, have, obviously they have the additional branding of Manchester United, which helps them out. But definitely one of the most exciting teams in the league at the moment, I think.
Mm. All of this in the midst of this new 3-year deal. BBC and Sky Sports will show Women's Super League games from next season, worth about £8 million a season. So it's the biggest women's football broadcast deal in the world. Kickoff times 6:30 on a Friday evening, which is a really clever move. Saturday morning, Sunday 12:30 and 6:30. So it doesn't clash with the Premier League matches. And just looking into the nuts and bolts of the deal, it does look like genuinely a really, really huge step forward. So Sky Sports are going to show 44 games across a season. And then there's the money aspect, which is good. You know, £8 million pounds a year doesn't hurt. But also Sky One are going to show some games for free as well. And BBC each round will show one game free to air as well. So you're getting the money, you're getting massive coverage on Sky. And then for those who don't have pay-per-view channels, BBC is obviously a massive audience, you know, and if people at home don't have Sky and they're starved of live sport because it's all behind a paywall these days, then suddenly a game on BBC could do really, really well. And yeah, this is in the context of, I was reading as well, Kathleen, Man City against Barcelona attracted 600,000 viewers in Spain and England. So, I mean, yeah, like all of that, something's brewing there very quickly. I know everybody's in a hurry to, you know, come on, can we get moving with the times? But it does feel now like things are really picking up speed.
Yeah, it's massive. I don't think I've ever seen such excitement around a broadcast deal or a sports deal in the women's game ever as there was last week when that was announced. Like, there was actually, like, there was lots of different calls and lots of different, like, press things, and there was almost journalists getting emotional on them because I think everyone has worked so hard to get to this point to, like, consistently prove that people want to watch these things, that they want to see these women perform. And this was just finally someone saying, yes, we believe you, we're going to put the money into this. I mean, 7 or 8 million a season, it's not going to do a massive amount for clubs like Chelsea or whatever. But then you think about, like, sponsorship deals, you think about these players, like you said, Friday evening, if a team are playing, what sort of sponsorship deals can they get in knowing that there's going to be a massive audience compared to playing on a Saturday and it's only on the FA player, which again is a great resource and has done wonders for the game in the totality, but like,
you have to seek it.
You have
to seek it out, don't you? That's the
problem. Exactly. And like, this is, even forget football, this is like the biggest deal for women's sport, like, across even like the American leagues. It reportedly is bigger than what the WNBA and the NWSL get, which is remarkable considering that they're normally much more well funded. But it's like I was saying, this is just gonna be a great opportunity to get that analysis after games, to start talking about the sport as a sport rather than maybe just all the storylines of inequality that come around it.
Yeah, because like, they can get boring. Do you know what I mean? Like, you just, again and again and again. And I find, because we really got to know the Irish players of late, especially the last campaign, the highlight show is good and you'd often stay watching because you want to, you know, get a glimpse of how the Irish players are going. But like, it's on at stupid o'clock on BBC and I don't know, it was just, I didn't find it terribly accessible or good, and it was, you know, fairly average analysis and jump to the next game and quick analysis next game.
If you look at tomorrow as well, like, the Champions League is on, quarterfinals, Chelsea, Wolfsburg and Man City and Barcelona. You said last week Barcelona game got 600,000 people, but again, they're at awful times in the middle of the day. I think it's like lunchtime and then 4 o'clock. It's not, you know, it's remarkable that they got that amount of viewership considering how awkwardly placed they have been. So that just shows, if you give it that prime slot, what sort of numbers are you going to start seeing then?
Yeah, it's exciting. It's going to be really interesting. Yeah. I think, next season it could really come alive. And as you said, sponsorship opportunities and everything else. The National League here started at the weekend with our Tricity sponsorship now, speaking of sponsorship. So P-Mount went away to Wexford Utes and won 1-0. They're obviously defending champions. Is it very much P-Mount team to beat again as a broad overview of the season ahead?
I think so. Like, obviously there's a lot of pressure on them going for that 3 in a row. It's not something that has been done before. And I think it's been interesting in that they very much have stuck with the squad that has shown them success over the last few years. You know, they have looked to their academy rather than bringing other players in the way that maybe like Shelburne and other teams have. But having Wexford straight off was such a big challenge for them. And I think, again, it was a game that could have gone anyway. I mean, if the penalty, Kylie Murphy's penalty, if that had gone in, it would have been 1-1 and we probably would have been looking at a slightly different setup for the season. Mm. But I think being able to get over that hurdle the first weekend, just scrape that 1-0 win will send them in such good seed for the rest of the season. And the fact that they had all that European experience last year as well will stand to them so much.
I was just looking to see what players currently in the National League here at home are in the current Ireland squad. So I may well be leaving somebody out, but Anya O'Gorman, Claire Walsh, Emily Whelan, Ellen Malloy, Jessica Zhu, Jamie Finn, Saoirse Noonan, now Shelburne has moved up from Cork, and Stephanie Roach is back at Piemont. Are they increasingly an endangered species, and will you have to be playing over in England or beyond to be in the Ireland team, or do you suspect over the next couple of years we'll always have a very healthy contingent here at home in the Ireland squad?
I think one of the really great things about the Ireland squad is that we tend to bring players in quite young. So a few of the players you've mentioned there, you know, they're only 16, 17, 18, and they're in there for experience. You know, we saw it last year with Ellen Malloy and stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that the way, by doing that, we're getting them in early, we're giving them the chance to like talk to those international players that have traveled. I think the league will always, in some sense, be viewed as a stepping stone to bigger things. I don't think we're close enough to making it a league where it stands entirely on its own. But I think if you look at the talent that has come from it over the last few years, and also the talent that's remained in it and still like competing for those international spots, then I think it's been really positive. Having said that, we are going to find it difficult, I think, in the next 5 years to compete with a lot of the other countries. I mean, we've seen it with the men's squad. And this is something I was talking about over the weekend. We're seeing it right now, the effects of the FAI's mismanagement with the team. We're quite lucky in on the women's side in that we still have quite a great young generation of players there. But like in a couple of years, are we going to see the knock-on effects of having not nurtured the league to the extent that we should, or as early as we should, in a way that, like, say the WSL now getting this massive broadcast deal.
Yeah.
Are we going to be able to compete with that? The NWSL and the US getting new teams. Are we going to be able to compete with these players being able to go to America and get a college education and then also be able to play soccer at an elite level? I think it's going to be really difficult, but I think there's such a great youth setup in the Women's National League, and the way that they support players and like actually help them to progress is something that's very unique to the league. And I think it is something that will stand the test of time.
Okay, hopefully so. Kathleen, great to have you on. Thanks so much for that. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers. Kathleen McNamee there of ESPN joining us live on the line. Again, if you're tuning in, finished 1-1 between Qatar and Ireland in Group A, which is our group. Azerbaijan 1, Serbia 2, the full time from earlier. Portugal 3-1 up away to Luxembourg with about 3 minutes to go in that game. So 3-1 winners, Portugal this evening. Ronaldo amongst the scorers. Diogo Jota got one as well. Our Football and Off the Ball is with thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise? The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.